Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we will continue our exploration into the culture or the cultures of consciousness. A couple of years ago, I was giving a talk at Burning Man, which I have been doing the last few times I've been to that wild, wacky event, and this very smart and friendly Italian fellow came up afterwards, and his name is Ferdinando Buscema, and it turned out that he was a magician as well as being a fan of my writing, and we got to be friends, and I've got to know him much better, and it's been a very fascinating trip for me because I think, like a lot of people, I've seen, you know, stage illusionist shows, and I've seen a couple mentalism acts, and, you know, it's all fine and well, kind of strange, kind of intriguing, but, you know, generally, you know, not the most highest or revolutionary art form or performances that I'm familiar with. But Ferdinando, both in his own work and his knowledge of the upper echelons of the magic world, introduced me to a whole new way, not only of that people are doing or have been doing magic for quite some time, but really more of a different way of thinking about it, and thinking about it in a way that's brings it much closer to a lot of the philosophical and issues and even spiritual issues that we've talked about on the show. I think to boil down one of the ideas that really blew my mind, Ferdinando, we were having a conversation. He was talking about how generally with sort of, you know, typical mediocre magicians, it's all about the trick. So, you know, you go and you look at the magician and he does a trick, and it's usually a he, and you can't figure it out, and he's sort of enjoying the fact that he knows something you don't, and you're trying to figure out in this sort of skeptical way, like, well, what is the trick? How could this possibly be done? And that's kind of the game. And Ferdinando said, yeah, but there's a whole other way you can be looking at it. You can look at a great magic act is a ritual, and the goal of the ritual is to create the sense of astonishment. And that really blew my mind, because it was very beautiful, it was very artistic, but it was also philosophically interesting. It took us beyond the game of skepticism and belief into some other zone where the kinds of effects the magicians produce can be a gateway into some of the deeper conundrums and wonderments of the human experience. And one of the magicians that Ferdinando turned me on to, who is a great name within the field and for many people who are fans of the art outside of it as well, is Max Maven. And I'm very happy to say that we have Max Maven on the show today. I got to see him perform a couple months ago when Ferdinando was performing at the Magic Castle, the wondrous, bizarre temple to magic in Los Angeles, and so I'm really looking forward to speaking with him. But before we talk to Max, I want to introduce our co-host Maja. Maja was there that evening and saw Max perform, and I know you're also a big fan of magic, aren't you?
Oh man, I am a huge fan of magic and have been for quite a while. And it was funny, you know, because I was doing a lecture series on magic and what it was and its connection to shamanism and the occult and hermeticism, and it was right at that time when I started doing the lecture series that I met the Larson family, you know, Erica and Liberty, and started going to see things at the Magic Castle, and the caliber of the performers just blew my mind. And it was through, it's like what, how you were saying that Ferdinando expressed it, that the trick has this quality to engender wonder in the minds of people. And for me, one of my favorite things about magic is that the purpose of a trick can alter your consciousness by perceiving something that you think is impossible. And so these master magicians like Max Maven, they can literally alter people's consciousness, you know, through the tricks that they're doing with their mind. So it's very profound to me, and it carries a very powerful effect. And most people, I think, don't realize that when they're just thinking of like a magician pulling a rabbit out of their hat or something. But it does have this total profundity.
Right. Well, let's bring Max on. Max, thanks so much for joining us here on Expanding Mind.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Great. And you're are you in L.A.?
I am.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, usually when I get people on the show, I like to find out a little bit about, you know, how they first started doing the thing that brought them here. And I know that it's common for serious magicians to begin their practices when they're relatively young, you know, 7, 8, 9 years old or something like that. Was uh-huh. this the case with you?
It is. I started somewhere around the age of 7, leading into 8. The reasons that most magicians begin in magic is not that positive a reason, positive in the sense of good. They usually sort of backdoor into magic with a less than ideal motivation. The situation is you have a kid, and in Western countries it's almost always a male, who is somewhere around the age of 7 or 8 or 9, who's having a difficult time coping with the world around him, because essentially he's powerless.
Mm.
And he's surrounded by his elders, his teachers, his friends, his family members, and he's not functioning as well as he would like. And he discovers magic because it is a form of coping. It is a mechanism by which he can cope with some form of psychological and or sociological maladjustment. In other words, if I can make the quarter disappear and mom doesn't know where it went, I have some leverage.
Hmm.
Now, that is not a ethically or morally wrong situation, but I think we could agree that it isn't the ideal use of an art form, be it magic or anything else.
I'm sorry. It's just like that's kind of what David Gordon White was talking about with the sinister yogi thing, right? That a lot of the underlying reason to get into things is always what? Power, money, and chicks. And unfortunately, magicians can be similar, the reason, because it is. It's kind of like sometimes dorks, and then they see that they can hold attention and hold influence and hold sway.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say sometimes. I would say almost all the time. there are some exceptions, but they are few and far between. And what normally happens, I mean, it is a very good coping mechanism. And so it works. And then for the majority of kids who have dabbled in magic in this way, by the time they hit around puberty, their worldview has changed. They devote their attention to other things. And then there are those who simply stay with magic. And of the ones who stay with magic, many of them, I don't want to say most, although it might be, stay with magic for the same reason as they started in the first place. And the result is they do magic that isn't very good, about much of anything. And it is in large measure because of that I think that magic gets a bad rap from people who have only been exposed to a small amount of magic, and what they've been exposed to has been of that type.
Mm. I think you're right. The question I would have for you is as someone who has gone much deeper into the art, would you say that was it more about discovering that actually magic had nothing to do with the sort of initial, or nothing necessarily to do with the initial sort of psychological benefits, or is it rather something subtler where the kind of, well, let's say, the way that you step outside of normal society by having these powers, that something that kids enjoy because of the power it gives them, that you're actually kind of alchemically or transforming that separation or that almost alienation from society into something much more sophisticated.
Boy, that's an interesting framing, and I'm not sure I can address it very well, because we're talking about so many different people with so many different relationships to this art form. But let me try and answer you sort of coming in sideways. I feel that magic, if you strip out that sociological starting point that most magicians have, ultimately magic is an art form that is no different than any other art form in the larger sense. It answers to the same rules, the same limitations, the same social positioning. And the biggest difference to me between magic and other art forms is the priority placed on mystery. In other words, a painter can have a list of technical points, not all of which need be used, but obviously color is almost certainly going to be toward the very top of the list for just about every painter. I can name exceptions, but by and large, the range of colors is a primary tool within the list of tools for painting. And you would also get things like texture and space and size and stroke and, arguably dozens more. And somewhere on that list, and it would vary for each given painter, but somewhere on that list, mystery would be an element. That doesn't mean it's a mandatory element, because I've certainly seen wonderful paintings that have no particular use of mystery. And yet I've also seen some great paintings where mystery is a very key element. But it isn't the number one element. And if you look at the work of a mystery performer, a magician, call it what you will, all of those tools I just described, all of those elements I just described, would fit on that person's list. The precise order, again, would be different depending on the individual, but the one thing we could say for sure is that if a magician is practicing his art or her art, that mystery is going to be up there at the top of that list. And that's the primary difference. It's not a very big difference, but it's the primary difference between the art of magic and other art forms.
Well, here's another question about that art. Obviously, there's strong links. Maja mentioned shamanism early on. There's strong links between the elements that go into a mystery performance in a contemporary situation and aspects of, let's say, traditional shamanic performance, where there is an element of mystery. There can be literal tricks, whether they are mentalist or sleight of hand, but it's created in an overall performance that really creates the possibility for wonder and change, and in the traditional sense, for a kind of mobilization of belief. I'm curious, because to kind of hone in on the way that the mystery performer shifts those rules, the contemporary mystery performer changes those rules in terms of the religious dynamic of belief and shifting into something in some ways very subtle, very difficult to describe exactly. So do you see the mystery arts that you perform as being evolved out of that tradition, or in some ways doing something fundamentally different?
No, I think they're the same. I think my personal analysis of all of this type of thing is that there is a point in the evolution of civilization, And when I say evolution, I don't necessarily mean evolving into something better, just evolving into something different. But there's an early point that shows up in virtually every human group where there is this thing called shamanism, which is remarkably similar from one group to the next, and which at its outset is actually a mixture of things that we now look at as three separate things. And those are science and technology, spirituality and religion, and art and aesthetics. And I think that these three kind of areas start merged together to the extent that I think for those going through that phase, it's very hard to separate anything out of this mix. And the shaman functions in all these three areas and all of the linking areas in between. And then what happens over time is that the three areas drift apart. And today, we tend to think of science and technology as being a very explicitly defined area that is far removed from the artistic corner of things, in turn far removed from the spiritual corner of things. But that, I think, is a human-made distinction.
Well, it's interesting, too, because technology, right, the tech part actually etymologically meant art. I mean, the whole phrase of even the word technology was about an art form in and of itself, and I think people forget that.
Well, I mean, the interaction between these three areas, even if we talk about it as if they're unconnected, it doesn't change the fact that they're connected. It just means that we talk about it in a certain way. Now, the particular way in which they're connected, the emphasis that may be placed on one thing by one person as opposed to another, that becomes very individual and very idiosyncratic, and there's no reason why it needs to be other than that.
Well,
I always picture this as a triangular map.
Mm-hmm.
Picture a big triangle, and in one corner we've got science and technology, in one corner we've got art and aesthetics, and in one corner we've got spirituality. Metaphysics, call it what you will. And these are all forms of exploration. And any human endeavor, if we remove the parts of human endeavor that we do simply because we have to, like eating food to sustain ourselves, every form of human endeavor, everything that can be put under the header of things we want to do as opposed to the things we need to do, can be placed somewhere on that triangular chart. But it may be a very different placement for two people even in the same profession.
So how would you say
that
your art relates to the world of spirituality? This is a really interesting dynamic, both in your just particular the mentalism work that you do, because it seems like you're reading minds, it seems like you're able to foretell the future. These kinds of powers we associate, or at least have been associated also with psychic powers. So how do you see your relationship to the spiritual end of that triangle?
Well, I guess I have to ask you to clarify whether you're talking about my personal offstage relationship to spirituality or my relationship to it when I'm on stage.
Good clarification. I will say I'll start off with the latter, with the experience that I have going to see Max Maven's show. You're not. In what ways are you playing with, satisfying, and challenging, let's say, the spiritual interpretation or experience of those effects?
Well, I don't know that I'm trying to challenge anyone's spiritual placement. Whatever individual may be, it's almost certain that that person's spiritual placement is not the same as mine. First, because I think people go in very different directions, and second of all, because I'm the sum of my parts, and they aren't the same as yours by definition. So I don't expect that your spiritual vantage point is going to be the same as mine, and I certainly have no interest in converting you to where I'm coming from in that regard, because what works for you may work far better for you than anything I could suggest. What I'm interested in doing is obviously creating an unusual experience for you, and I'm hoping that when you leave my show, you will be looking at the world just a little bit differently than when you entered.
Well, that, I have a question for you in terms of that. I'm just curious if you yourself, over the course of your performance, have had a numinous, mysterious experience that altered your consciousness, because you usually lead the tricks, right? So I was kind of curious if through performing a trick, if you have ever had an experience of the numinous while your performance was happening.
Yes. I dare say that there probably is not a mentalist who hasn't had that happen to him.
Mm.
We can use the word mentalist now. We didn't used to be able to because nobody knew what it meant. People thought it was an escapee from an institution. But now with the success of the television series, people at least have a clue as to what the word means. It's a general word and has lots of very idiosyncratic variations. But at any rate, there is not, I think it's fair to say that there's no performer who has delved seriously into the performance of theatrical mentalism who has not had just amazing moments in performance where they suddenly felt like they knew something and they didn't know why, and it turned out what they thought they knew was there, was correct. I think every mentalist has gone through that experience.
I asked Fernando about once when we were talking about not just his own work, but other aspects of mentalism. And it's always a fascinating conversation to have with mystery performers, where you know I'm not interested in trying to dig out information that you wouldn't be giving me anyway. That's not the game. But the game is to figure out ways to get a better general sense of what your art is like. And one of the things that I had asked him is to sort of say, well, when I see some of the most profoundly puzzling demonstrations of mentalism, where obviously I'm aware that I'm not aware of all of the elements of it, but if we leave off the category of a plant, if we're dealing with an authentic human audience member and the mentalist and
right,
whatever the performance is, that there are things that are so amazing that even though I believe that they rest on psychological principles rather than supernatural principles,
mm-hmm,
that the nature of those psychological principles would still blow my mind, or at least the way that they are deployed in the performance situation.
Mm-hmm.
It's like,
well, I think like we're surrounded by functions, I'll use that word, that we take for granted because we don't particularly look at them. I'll give you a perfect example. Crossing the street. When you're standing on the street, on a sidewalk, you look left and right and decide whether it is an opportune moment to cross the street. Obviously, that means you wish to cross the street at a time when a car is not going to mow you down. Fair enough?
Yeah.
And so let's say that you see a car in the distance heading toward you. You look, and you know whether with a normal stride or a slightly sped up stride, you can make it across the street with room to spare, or whether it's too chancy and you'll wait until after the car is gone. Now, to technically accomplish this, if we, for example, were to ask some sort of a computer to do it, they would have to make some extraordinary calculations very quickly. They would have to measure the distance between the car and yourself, the speed at which the car is going, perhaps identify certain characteristics of the road surface, figure out the length of the distance between one side of the street to the other, the length of the person's average stride. That's an awful lot of different things, and I'm barely scratching the surface of how many things you'd have to put into this equation to figure out whether or not you could safely cross the street. And yet it's something that we all do every day, and we're all pretty good at it. And the proof of that is that not too many of us get mowed over when we're walking across the street. And to me, at least, that's a very mysterious ability. It's a very amazing ability. But it's one that, because we are so used to it, and because it has a pragmatic quality, we're not doing it to show off, and we're not doing it to change our position in the community, and we're not doing it for to aesthetically alter the landscape. We're doing it because practically we need to get across the street, so we don't tend to think of it in terms of being something amazing.
So there are other principles like that, other aspects of our knowingness that we're just not even aware of as being functions.
That we take for granted, yeah.
So here is the question that I asked Ferdinando that I'll ask you now, is that given that there are lots of functions that you are aware of and are deploying in a situation, in a mentalist act, in your act, that I'm not entirely aware of, nonetheless, is it the case that at least in parts of the performance you are, and this is the best analogy I can come up with, performing without a net?
Yes,
crossing the tightrope without a net.
Yes, I have on occasion referred to myself as being from the Carl Willenda School of Show Business.
And who is Carl Willenda?
Carl Willenda was the patriarch of a family of tightrope walkers who were kings in the circus world, and who had several major accidents because they would insist on working without an ad. And he eventually died walking across a canyon or something at the age of 70 or something.
70 years old walking across a canyon.
Well, we hope that fate does not lie ahead for you.
When I refer to myself as being a member of the Carl Willenda School, the advantage I have is that if I misstep, the worst I get is a bruised ego.
That's great. And then isn't it part of, even in some ways, a great performer will be able to take slips and weave them into the experience as well. That part of the art is the dealing with the near miss, if you will.
Well, in theater, there are a lot of different approaches to acting, but one phrase that comes up very frequently in the study of theater is being in the moment. And with the type of work that I do, because it's all involving members of the audience, who I don't know up until that moment, I damn well better be in the moment at every moment, because something could go wrong. So I have to be very alert and very aware, even if I'm doing, I have a 2-hour theater show and much of it is scripted, but there are places in that show where the script is at best a skeleton script. Because so much of that script is going to be written by the participants at that moment.
And I suspect that's part of what people are responding to when, in terms of their enjoyment, not even their enjoyment, but also the sense that something is really happening, that there's some, when there's elements of, whether you want to call it improvisation or incredible attention paid to that particular moment in time, when it's not just a script running, when there's an interactive element, I feel like everybody kind of senses that on some level, and it's part of what makes the events and the effects seem even more powerful.
Well, I think it's certainly an element that is very present for most of the people watching.
Well, great. Well, so we're here at Expanding Mind talking to Max Maven. We're going to take a short break here and hear some promos for other shows on the on PRN, Progressive Radio Network, and we'll be back in a sec.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
This is John Rappaport inviting you to my new radio show on the Progressive Radio Network, which will air every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm an investigative reporter. I've spent 20 years researching health and medical fraud, deep politics. I'll have lots of very knowledgeable guests on the show who have information to share with you so that you can live a more healthy and informed life. Join me every Wednesday on PRN. That's 7 p.m. Eastern Time, the John Rappaport Show. See you then.
This is Ellen Kamai, co-host of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Dr. Eugene Zamperone and I have been deeply involved with indigenous cultures and combine traditional knowledge with the latest research in natural health care. Join us each week on PRN from 1 to 2 p.m. every Monday. We'll bring you authors, professors, researchers, and activists who are committed to bringing you the latest information which you can use to ensure maximum wellness for yourself, your cells, and your family. Tune in to Progressive Radio Network every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time or anytime by visiting the archives. This is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.
Do you have a medical question or concern and would like to get a second opinion? If so, make sure you tune in to Second Opinion with Dr. Ronald Klatz. Dr. Klatz is president and founder of the AFREM, American Academy of Anti-Aging Medicine, the largest physician-based anti-aging organization in the world. Each week, Dr. Klatz will talk with expert guests from the field of anti-aging, functional, and regenerative medicine. So if you want to live a longer, healthier life, tune in to Second Opinion with Dr. Klatz Sunday nights at 10 p.m. Eastern here on PRN.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind. We're here today talking about mentalism and the magic, and we're speaking with Max Maven. It's a very me show today. Max, I'm pretty good at asking stinker questions, so I have a little bit of a stinker question for you.
All right.
I know you said that there's not much danger if you misstep except for an ego blow, but I'm very fascinated with the history of mentalism because it's tied up with mesmerism, and a lot of the stage performances did in fact involve danger. In fact, people were killed on stage. Namely young women, by some of the hypnotists, and of course that's where we get the whole Svengali and Trilby thing. And it's fascinating to me that it kind of went in two directions where people would take it in a manipulative place, and the other place it went was the mesmerism route where it was used to heal people and heal diseases. And I'm just curious if, like you, who becomes this kind of, you are a master mentalist, really, so you have this ability to hold influence over people, and I personally believe influence happens through sympathy. But I was curious if in all of your years doing performances, if you have noticed that anything has had an either ill effect on someone or a curative effect through your performance, if you've ever seen that.
I would say the answer is yes, but on very, very small levels. people are certainly sometimes shaken up by my shows. And sometimes that means shaken up in a good way, and sometimes it means disturbed. But having said that, I certainly, nothing in my work is even mildly associated with healing in the sense that you're describing mesmerists. I would also disagree strongly with your characterization that was a common aspect of mesmerism. I think, mm-hmm. in fact, it was not a very common aspect, and certainly not in the theatrical context.
The healing part, you mean?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a big difference between going to someone's home or going to someone's office who claims that he or she can heal you with, you know, magnetic forces or whatever it may be, and going to a theater and having someone claim to do that same thing, but on a stage in front of an audience. And I really don't think that there were almost any theatrical hypnotists who did that. Quite the opposite.
Part of the issue is that Maj is talking about the origins of the effect, and I think
I'm getting static on my end. I can't hear what you're saying.
Oh, excuse me.
He said there was a little static. Can you hear okay now?
Yeah, that's better. I wasn't ducking your question. I just couldn't hear it.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. Just sort of saying about the origins of mesmerism do take place in a healing context, and it's kind of the way that the same sorts of performances can mobilize very different effects in different situations, so that
mm-hmm.
you can have very similar types of performance, but in a more shamanic or healing setting, the goal is to elicit some kind of perhaps placebo effect driven catharsis or experience.
Oh, there's no question. That I'm not disagreeing with. I'm disagreeing with the characterization of theatrical hypnotists, mesmerists, using their theatrical performances as a venue for healing. I mm-hmm. think that is a rarity.
One of the other things that happens a lot with mentalism today and with magic more broadly is that it's for some performers, they very consciously set themselves up against spiritual or psychic claims. And of course, this has been part of modern magic since at least Houdini. And I'm kind of curious how you see the relationship of your art to this sort of cause of skepticism or the cause of a disenchanting or undermining the claims of psychic or overtly spiritual, supernatural performers, at least in terms of what their claims are,
uh-huh.
because you seem to be doing something different than some of the straight, more kind of debunking skeptic sides of,
mm-hmm.
of mentalism.
Well, my attitude toward people's belief systems is essentially, as long as they don't involve beating me up, I'm pretty fine with almost anything. So I have lots of friends whose belief systems are radically different from mine, and if it works for them, I'm happy for them. So I'm not out to change someone's belief system just because I may think it's built on sand. And I suppose that sets me apart from some other people in the field. I very willfully take a very centrist position. And if we look at belief systems on a line sort of comparable to politics. You know, you've got your hard right, diehard skeptics who who feel if it's not secular, it doesn't exist. And then on the other extreme, you've got your diehard spiritualists, for want of a better term, who will assign mystical value to every moment of their lives. And I'm very much in the middle there. And I'm not threatened particularly by either side. I believe I'm the only person in the world who can make the following statements. If you were to pick up the phone at this moment and call James Randi and say, what do you think of Max Maven? He would say, he's a friend of mine. He's a good guy. And if you were to pick up the phone at this moment and call Uri Geller and ask him the same question, he'd give you essentially the same answer. And well, I don't know if anybody else has been able to keep a comfortable and positive relationship with both extremes, but I'm happy to do that. So,
well, I love that middle zone myself, and in my own work as a journalist and author writing about spiritual topics, but also very informed by neuroscience and technology, mm-hmm. that I've kind of devoted my life towards articulating that middle zone. I'm curious how you got there. Was it partly through your own explorations, both of stage magic and mentalism, but also your research into the occult, and I know you're widely read and have done a lot of work. I'm kind of curious how you came to that position, or is it just temperamental? Have you always just sort of found yourself naturally sitting there in that centrist position?
Boy, that's a really interesting question. I'm not sure I have a good answer for you. I guess you can sum up my personal philosophy by saying you should be skeptical of everything but accept the possibility of anything. Because to veer away from that position, you're going to cut out a lot of opportunities for insight and learning and growth. So
go ahead.
No, I was just saying I'm all for people being skeptical, and I'm all for people deciding to put skepticism aside. Because when you get down to it, when you get to the extreme ends of either side of that spectrum, it ultimately comes down to faith, which is what it is. It's a very separate thing from most of our other interactions with the world around us.
Well, I'm curious if you have personally, through dialogue, because you, the world of magicians, I mean, this is a total generalist statement, but there's like the ones that are kind of very skeptical. It's like you said, like the Uri Geller, James Randi split, and then there's kind of people that go either way, and then some that are in the middle, and then people who just kind of explore. But I'm curious if in many of your conversations with people on both sides, if you have had any of the skeptics, like, have you had moments where they had an experience of the numinous with you? Like, have you been involved in anything where you have, like, had something unexplainable and mysterious happen as you were having any of the discussions with the skeptics, or does that not necessarily happen at all?
Nothing specific is coming to mind, but I will bring up that a lot of that has to do with the mindset of an individual as to what they perceive.
Right.
You know, Richard Wiseman, who is a friend who works, he's a professor at the University of Hertfordshire, and he wrote a book a few years ago called The Luck Factor. And his premise was that there are people who are lucky and people who aren't. But he wasn't basing this on some sort of cosmic dice game or something, but rather with the mental attitude of people. That people who considered themselves lucky had better luck than people who considered themselves not lucky. And one of the tests, I mean, it's not an easy thing to quantify or test, but he actually did put together a test that I think has really interesting implications. They had interviewed people and about whether they thought they were lucky or not. And then afterwards, the people were asked to walk from wherever the interview took place to another building for the next round. And on the sidewalk that these people were walking along, they dropped a piece of paper money. It was British currency, but let's assume it was like a $5 bill or something. And it was just sitting on the sidewalk. And the people who considered themselves lucky noticed the bill and picked it up substantially more often than the people who considered themselves to be unlucky.
Mm.
So
it's as if our perception of possibility gives room for those possibilities to actually manifest in our experience.
I think so. I mean, I think in a general sense, that's what we can glean from this experiment. And so if people are looking for examples in their lives of synchronicity or some sense of precognitive awareness that shouldn't theoretically work, they're more likely to spot it. Now, I think that also means they're more likely to spot things that aren't that at all, but that are close enough that they embrace it, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's interesting to me because that experiment reminds me of one that I had read about in some of the early mesmerism and animal magnetism research, and
right.
It was in this book by Baron Dupote. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he was studying animal magnetism. He did this one experiment where he had people wait in a room, and then he went into a different room and he drew an invisible line with his finger, which went in a specific path across the floor. And then he would invite people in one by one and he would just tell them to walk across the room.
Mm-hmm.
And invariably, each of the people walked along the path that he had traced with his finger. And he had, like, you know, people witnessing, and it was set up fairly scientifically in an experimental form. And one of the things that the mesmerist and, you know, that Mesmer himself was trying to find was that thing that everyone would perceive and be susceptible to. And so he was trying to find that thing where, like, everyone would find the money on the sidewalk because he had put it into their minds that it was there. And that is, like, kind of a difference where the influence comes in, right? Like, it's one thing to present something on what people feel themselves psychologically,
right,
and then for someone else to guide them. And then so that seems like kind of a little bit of what is going on in mentalism. And so I was just
right.
curious, like, what how
the Mesmer story is by no means uninteresting, but before fully getting on that program, I would suggest considering the Clever Hans syndrome.
What's that?
Clever Hans was a horse back in the, I think, 1600s. One of a number of learned animals, but Clever Hans was probably the most famous. These were animals which could apparently understand spoken English, or in the case of Clever Hans, I suppose it was spoken German. But in other words, someone would be asked to call out a simple math problem. You know, what is 2 + 3? And Hans would take one of his forepaws and bang out 5 on the ground. And in similar fashion, he could answer yes or no questions and so forth. And for a long time, because this became very popular, and for a long time, the presumption of those who observed this, whether scientists or not, was that this horse somehow just was much smarter than the average horse and and was able to process spoken language. And eventually, some people tried to test the situation, and they discovered that, in fact, people were unconsciously cueing the horse.
Mm.
They weren't doing huge gestures. They weren't saying anything or touching the horse. But the horse figured out that if he stamped his foot on the ground, at a certain point, his trainer or someone else would do a slight stiffening of their body, a slight change of their facial expression, and that was his cue to stop.
Mm.
Now, that's a pretty remarkable thing in and of itself, that a horse figures out how to do that and then does it so successfully and does it in a context where the people who are cueing the horse don't have any idea that they're cueing the horse.
Oh.
It's just a different, it's remarkable, but it's a different remarkable thing than what the people watching thought. I'm not saying that that's how Mesmer accomplished his demonstration of having people follow an invisible line that he had previously drawn. But if Mesmer, particularly if it was not just Mesmer alone, but Mesmer with witnesses, as you described, and if all the witnesses, however many people are in that room, if everyone knows where the person is meant to go, you know, are they meant to veer left or right? I wouldn't be at all surprised if they kind of steered the person.
Huh, very interesting.
Fascinating stuff.
And I'm not, look, I wasn't there. I'm not saying this is definitely what happened. Nor should I say it was definitely what happened. I'm simply saying that it's worth bearing in mind that there is a very well-established historical precedent for something similar.
Mm-hmm.
What I love about this discussion right here is one, your care in making the distinction between saying, look, there is a well-established historical explanation, though that doesn't mean we know that it applies to the incident with Mesmer, which is always an important distinction that many hardcore skeptics leave aside. But even more than that is just that there's a wonderment even in the skeptical explanation, that there's an extraordinary capacity that we have to do this consciously or in many ways unconsciously, to read and understand, so that intuition is a vast and complex and multi-layered.
Right. One of the things I find unfortunate. I have a lot of friends who are diehard skeptics, and there's among them are some really terrific and really smart people, but some of them I feel veer into. I used the word before, but they veer into faith. And I'm not sure that faith is very useful in mm-hmm. the context of trying to address objectively an outside thing. I think faith is an important thing, and I think a lot of people, their lives work better because they have faith. But I'm not sure I see any difference between someone who has faith in a given religious narrative as opposed to someone who has faith in a given scientific narrative.
Mm-hmm.
The person who would look at the Mesmer story and say definitively, conclusively, this was unconscious cueing, as in Clever Hans, I think is operating a faith.
Mm.
Because we genuinely don't know.
Experience becomes so important, and on either side, both spiritual, scientific, and artistic, like, you have to have some kind of experience, which really is the only thing that kind of makes it real.
Mm-hmm.
The other side of that I'd like to ask you about here as we're winding up is the whole experience of not knowing. It seems to me that one of the things that you are offering in your show, and I know that's been, you know, explicitly addressed in some of your performances, is an opportunity to experience and reframe not knowing. Can you talk a little bit about why that seems important?
Well,
I
mentioned earlier that I have a 2-hour theater show, and the full title of that show is Max Maven Thinking in Person, An Evening of Knowing and Not Knowing. So that's very much a key to what I'm involving myself in a theatrical performance. We do have this tendency in the West, particularly in American culture, to kind of pride ourselves on knowing everything, where we clearly don't, but we behave as if we do. And I'm a voracious learner. I read a great deal and explore a great deal, and I like to know as much as I can know. But one of the things that I think helped me become an adult was the realization at some point in my, I don't know, late teens, early 20s, that as to how much I didn't know and as to how much I would never know. And I don't think that's a pejorative.
It opens
space
for mystery.
Ignorance is not necessarily something to boast about, but it isn't something to be ashamed of. Stupidity is another story, and the two words are sometimes used interchangeably, and I don't think they really are.
But even not knowing is a little different than ignorance. I mean, you know, ignorance almost is like meaning we just don't know what's going on, some specific fact or some element of the situation. But not knowing, to me, also implies a kind of existential position, an acceptance and a willingness and even a celebration
mm-hmm.
of the edges of
mm-hmm.
our knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, the kind of classic why I so love great mystery performance, great magic, is that I get the intense hit of astonishment
mm-hmm.
when the thing that I cannot believe is possible occurs. But then following that is as I sort of return slightly changed to my ordinary frame of mind is a kind of ambiance of not knowing that I very much enjoy. I enjoy having this opportunity to let it go.
Well, I think ultimately it's healthy. It's healthy to accept that there are things one doesn't know, and it's healthy to accept that there are things that are that even if we do know, we don't fully know. We have a real propensity in this culture to assimilate new ideas and new technologies very quickly. You know, when the fax machine first came into being, just under 30 years ago, it was miraculous. There had never been anything quite like it. You could actually sit in one place, draw a picture, stick that piece of paper into a machine, and in a matter of 4 or 5 minutes, a facsimile of that picture would show up in a machine thousands of miles away.
Mm.
I mean, that's genuinely jaw-dropping stuff. And yet, here we are, you know, barely more than a quarter of a century later, and faxes are antiques. We don't use them anymore because they're too slow, they're too limited. I can scan something and email it to you in a matter of you know, an eighth the time it would take to fax it. And so we sort of dismiss faxing as being, you know, this old-fashioned creaky mechanism, and the speed with which we're able to do that, the speed with which we're able to assimilate a radically new idea into our lives, and then it transforms from something genuinely amazing to something genuinely pedestrian. Almost right. Overnight. That's pretty astonishing.
Well, Max, thank you so much for keeping the wonderment side of the equation alive with your remarkable performance. And I encourage listeners to, you know, seek out. And I don't know, is there a website or some place where people
My
can
website
find out?
Is maxmaven.com.
And, thanks so much for joining us here on Expanding Mind, Max. It was a real treat.
It was fun.
Thank you so much.
Sure thing.